Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for Thursday, the 25th of June already. The growing right-wing terror threat was a piece in the New York Times on June 16th, the day before the massacre in Charleston, South Carolina. The authors who are with us this hour say that the main terrorist threat in the U.S. is not from violent Muslim extremists, but from right-wing extremists, and they say just ask the police. They conducted a survey with Police Executive Research Forum last year of 382 law enforcement agencies. 74% reported anti-government extremism as one of the top three terrorist threats in their jurisdiction. 39% listed extremism connected with Al-Qaeda or like-minded terrorist organizations. And only 3% identified the threat from Muslim extremists as severe, compared with 7% for anti-government forms of extremism. We have with us this hour Professor David Schanzer, professor of public policy at Duke University and director of the Triangle Center on Terrorism and Homeland Security. He is the lead author of a widely cited National Institute of Justice study on domestic radicalization, anti-terror lessons of Muslim Americans, rather. Professor Schanzer, thank you very much for being with us this hour. Okay, we don't have him at the moment, but we will find him in a moment. Professor Charles Kurzman is with us as well, professor of sociology at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, co-director of the Carolina Center for the Study of the Middle East and Muslim Civilizations, author of several books, including The Missing Martyrs, Democracy Denied, and The Unthinkable Revolution in Iran. Professor Kurzman, thank you very much for being with us. All right. Well, sorry for the confusion here. Professor Schanzer, are you there? So we'll welcome phone calls for both our guests this hour, and we're just trying to track them down. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. I think we got things fixed. Professor Schanzer, there you go. I can hear you. Hi.
Hi.
Hi. Thank you very much for being with us. And we will be with Professor Kurzman in just a moment. It was striking to us, and I'm wondering if it was striking to you as well, that the article that you wrote that was in the New York Times was the day before the Charleston massacre.
Well, it was just horrible timing in some ways. I'm just also struck by the fact that we're having this conversation when some of the first funerals are being conducted. And it's just so sad. What can you say?
It is sad. So tell us about the study that you did. You spoke with 382 law enforcement agencies to look at threats, domestic threats and Muslim terrorist threats, right-wing attacks, anti-government threats, and those coming from other places.
Well, it was an online survey of almost all the large law enforcement agencies in the country, and then a sampling of the smaller ones. And we asked them a number of questions. We asked, was Al-Qaeda and ISIS-related terrorism to rank the severity of the threat? And then we asked them about other forms of terrorism, and we listed a whole bunch of them, right-wing and other forms of terrorism. And consistently throughout, they reported that from their perception, again, this is local police, not the FBI, but from their perception that, you know, the things that bother them on a day-to-day basis, it was this anti-government extremism that was a greater concern to them than, you know, the threats coming from ISIS and Al-Qaeda.
Mm-hmm. And you list in the article some of those examples of anti-government extremism. There are quite a few, aren't there, that have taken place in the last few years?
Well, there are. We can start talking about them, but of course we have this tragedy in Charleston, you know, right on our doorstep. So they just haven't gotten as much, until this recent one, as much attention and notoriety as almost every time, you know, somebody is arrested. They haven't even done any violence, but they are arrested because they are planning on leaving the country to possibly join ISIS. It's actually a major story. It makes national news. It's often cited on CNN. And then you could have an instance of right-wing extremism, which actually led to a death. And it's not a national story.
Why?
Well, you know, we'd be speculating. We don't really know. I think a lot has to do with the aftermath of 9/11, this notion that foreign terrorism can leak its way into this country. And there's a lot of fear and legitimate concern about that in this country. I think it's a fear of the other, definitely prevalent. This is something, you know, that is in many people's minds connected with a religion that they don't know or understand, by people with from other countries or who have immigrated from other countries. And it seems, you know, just very foreign and therefore kind of scarier to Americans, mm-hmm. Whereby anti-government protest in some ways is, you know, in our DNA. I'm not saying people accept that, but it's maybe just less familiar to them.
And we do have Professor Charles Kurzman with us now from the University of North Carolina. Professor Kurzman, thank you very much for being with us.
Hello, I'm glad to be here.
I'm sorry we had problems with the phones, but here you both are now. While we are burying people in South Carolina and this enormous tragedy continues, I need to ask, I know it wasn't totally the focus of the work that you did, but this attention that's been paid to this Council of Conservative Citizens, evidently Dylann Roof was influenced by that group in some way, and that group has been giving money to politicians in this country for some time and used to be another name, morphed into Council of Conservative Citizens. Is that in any way an anti-government group, the kind that you were looking at, or is it something different?
Well, that's one of many groups around the country that might be potentially linked with anti-government extremism. But so far as I know, they're a legal organization, have not engaged in any violence whatsoever themselves. And I think we ought to make a distinction here and not cast aspersions on anybody who's on everybody who's critical of the government just because a fringe of that political movement might engage in violence. I think that's parallel to the treatment we ought to pay for Muslim community members, most of whom are entirely peaceful, law-abiding folks, and shouldn't be maligned by being associated with fringe members of their community either.
Mm-hmm. Let's look at more at some of the things that law enforcement agents said to you as you were conducting your survey. I would imagine because of the incidents that weren't very nationally exposed that some officers are probably a little nervous when they're stopping people for some kind of infringement. It might be a traffic infringement, knowing that this kind of anti-police, anti-government groups are out there, that it makes their job more difficult, doesn't it?
Well, it certainly does, and their awareness has been heightened by it, of course, by actual murders of police officers by individuals who have this anti-government right-wing ideology. So I think it's growing understanding and awareness among law enforcement agencies that, especially in some parts of the country, that these individuals are out there. And you know, when there's a traffic stop, that's actually a big moment of confrontation because it's not just about them getting a ticket, but people with this ideology don't even accept the authority, the legal, legitimate authority of these individuals to enforce the law. So a traffic stop is a moment of confrontation and actually one of great hazard for a law enforcement agent.
Are they lone individuals who just sort of stumble themselves upon this kind of ideology, Professor Kurzman, or are there a number of organized groups that espouse this kind of ideology?
There are a number of groups out there. These are fringe organizations and tend not to be very large groups. But I think there's a concern also among law enforcement that individuals might be sort of self-radicalized, reading stuff on the internet and coming to their own conclusions, not necessarily members of any organization. So that makes it a much more disparate, dispersed sort of threat, not something where you would go into a single organization and be able to get rid of the entire threat all at once.
Mm-hmm. And before we were able to make contact with you, Professor Schanzer was talking about the fact that a lot of the incidents that have already taken place, which are horrendous, don't seem to become the fodder for widespread national attention, a lot of news focus. Why is that?
Well, I think we have a national narrative, sort of a post-traumatic holdover from 9/11, perhaps, that America is under threat, under siege from outside, that we have external enemies, and certainly the news of these horrific civil wars taking place in various parts of the world are very present for us. And the fear that they would spill over into the United States, I think, is quite a real concern. We've been very fortunate that those conflicts have not spilled over into the United States nearly as much as we were bracing ourselves for after 9/11. But I think we still have this narrative. It's something that plays out in media coverage. It's something that plays out, I suspect, in political debates. And it may not reflect the actual levels of threats that we've experienced in recent years. It doesn't seem to match law enforcement's assessment of these threats in the survey that we conducted.
Mm-hmm. So tell me, how did they assess these threats? What did law enforcement people have to say about radicalization from the Middle East, radicalization among right-wing extremists?
There's certainly concern of extremism that's inspired by Al-Qaeda or by the self-proclaimed Islamic State. These are taken seriously. We saw almost 40% of the agencies in our survey listed that threat as one of the major threats that they're facing in the area of violent extremism. So there's great concern, I would say. And especially because the strategy of the Islamic State has been to try to radicalize do-it-yourselfers, basically, instead of trying to train them or get folks involved in elaborate plots with high technologies and long preparation time, which was Al-Qaeda's specialty. ISIS is saying use whatever you have at hand. It could be a knife or a gun, things that are readily available. You don't have to kill or injure a lot of people to get a lot of attention. And I think they have been sadly accurate in that we've seen relatively low-tech attacks, like the one in Garland, Texas, with two individuals shooting at an anti-Islamic conference. Get a huge amount of attention that brings publicity for that organization. They see that as a success, even though the attack itself did not cause any fatalities other than the attackers themselves.
Mm-hmm. You write in your article in the Times, right-wing extremists average 337 attacks per year. That's a lot in the decade after 9/11, causing a total of 254 fatalities.
Yes, well, definitions differ, and so it's very, we have to be careful about these figures, but that comes from a report from the Combating Terrorism Center at the U.S. Military Academy. It includes hate crimes and all sorts of other things that might not be included in other definitions of terrorism or violent extremism. Nonetheless, there is a consistency among these different data sets. Suggesting that extremism by violent extremist attacks and plots, disrupted plots by Muslims, are not the largest single source or stream of violent extremism in the United States.
Mm-hmm. So, Professor Shanzer, what's the answer to this? Is it more media attention on all of this, or is there something more that we need to look at?
Well, I think with both of these forms of extremism, I think the most promising or route for trying to deal with it is to work with communities to try to build resilience, understand what the grievances are, what people are attracted to those grievances, and try to work with them to explain to them why they are headed down a path that's very unproductive for their life and is wrong on its merits. And that's a hard thing to do. And I think we're beginning to make efforts in that regard. The president has a national strategy to combat violent extremism. But in many respects, it's still in its infancy.
Mm-hmm. How do you find people who are attracted to that ideology?
Well, everybody has a community. They have parents, they go to school, or they have a job. They're constantly, in the modern age, they're interacting with people on social media or electronic communications. So it's, people leave a lot of clues, and it's very rare that we have one of these incidents that we can't go back and say, oh my goodness, this person was saying this, or he had these books on his night table. He made this statement in public. How come we didn't know? And of course, we don't want to live in a society where law enforcement is ubiquitous. But I think if the community is sensitized and is committed to trying to take people and steer them in a better path when they see evidence of this, I think that is really the best way to build resiliency and to prevent violence in the long run.
Mm-hmm. Is there a connection between anti-government, the government is collapsing, Professor Kurzman, and a fear that the government is going to come and take away your guns?
Absolutely. We see these ideologies intertwined in some cases. There are, I should mention, very disparate types of ideologies and movements that fall under this category of anti-government extremism. But yes, there are folks who believe that the government of the United States has fallen into the wrong hands, and that it presents a threat somehow that it is taking over American society. Some of these ideologies are linked to the presence of an African-American president. Some of them are not overtly racial, but trace what they consider the illegitimacy of the U.S. government back to wrong turns taken in the 18th century that have taken away the sovereignty of the individual, in their view.
We're going to
let's make very clear, though, that anybody who is anti-gun control and pro-gun has every right to do that, and is doesn't have any responsibility for what this individual did in Charleston. The question is, how do we find the difference between people who are activated politically and then those who decide to take those political views and act upon them in a violent way? And that is the real challenge we face.
Yeah. And are the people who have committed these atrocious acts that you talk about in the New York Times, are they people who have publicly said what their viewpoints are? Or do we first find out about them when they have gone up to a courthouse and fired an assault rifle at police officers?
Well, some of them have left traces. The suspect in the Charleston church shooting apparently created a website with a manifesto that says all sorts of violent racist things, and also anti-government sentiments, such as the statement, "I hate the sight of the American flag." I wonder whether law enforcement is monitoring those types of sites with the same diligence. I hope it is, that they're monitoring sites that issue praise for ISIS or Al-Qaeda.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting that we frequently hear about the radicalization of some American youth from these ISIS websites. I don't even know how you go to one of those, but you almost never hear about radicalization from some of these extremist right-wing groups. You just don't hear about them.
Yeah, I think that it isn't a national story. They tend to be local stories when an incident occurs or when there's an arrest. And it doesn't fit into an overarching narrative where, look, you would say, look, see, here's another one. Here's another one. The way we do when a young Muslim gets arrested.
We welcome phone calls for both our guests, and here's how you reach our conversation, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, at K Dunn Show. Professor Charles Kurzman, professor of sociology at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and co-director of the Carolina Center for the Study of the Middle East and Muslim Civilizations, Professor David Shanzer, Professor of Public Policy at Duke University and Director of the Triangle Center on Terrorism and Homeland Security are our guests. We're referencing, and we'll put it on our Facebook page in case you didn't see it, the growing right-wing terror threat, which appeared in the New York Times on June 16, the day before the massacre in Charleston, South Carolina. And it goes on to talk about the fact that if you keep up with the news, you know that a small but steady stream of American Muslims radicalized by overseas extremists are engaging in violence here in the U.S. But the authors say the headlines can mislead. The main terrorist threat in the U.S. is not from violent Muslim extremists, but from right-wing extremists. Just ask the police, which is what our guest did. So we'll be with you in a moment. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The growing right-wing terror threat this hour. Our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Ed in West Allis is our first caller gentleman. Hi, Ed.
Good afternoon. The influence of extreme right-wing ideology is in our police departments themselves. And we in Wisconsin have experienced this firsthand under the reign of Scott Walker. During the recall election, police departments across the state rousted people who were working for the election of Tom Barrett, made life miserable for them. I had a firsthand experience with a very famous cop in this city out at Miller Park, and I was not allowed to pass out anti-Walker material in a designated area. And on June the 6th, the day after the election, I think we had the clearest example of this when the Milwaukee Police Department, with their mounted horse patrol, chased many of us union members from Marquette Park to Plankinton and Michigan in downtown Milwaukee and just trampled all over us. This is something that, as I say, we have firsthand knowledge of. The police department, the largest police union in the state, endorsed Walker in 2010. They re-endorsed him in 2011. And there's this symbiotic relationship with politicians like Walker who espouse this extreme, virulent, hateful, right-wing agenda. And the enforcement of this gets played out on the streets with your local police department.
All right, Ed, thanks for your call. I don't know how familiar you are with Wisconsin politics, but would either of you like to comment on this?
Well, you know, there's politics and extremism, and when we're talking about extremism, we're talking about individuals who intentionally use violence against civilians, innocent civilians, to try to make a political point. And so I don't think, and I'm not familiar with these examples, but I don't think any of that falls into what we're really talking about today at all.
Yeah. I think you're right. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655 for you to join our conversation this hour. In the article in the New York Times, you found that there has been, over the past year, you write, self-proclaimed Islamic State's efforts to radicalize American Muslims, which began after your survey ended, may have increased threat perception somewhat, but not by much. What did you find as you were doing interviews with counterterrorism specialists all over the country on that issue?
Well, we asked them to go into, you know, why they ranked things more the way they did on the survey. And what we found, I think, is that that right-wing threat was just, it really resonated with law enforcement because, you know, it affected them. This thing called the sovereign citizen movement, which a lot of your listeners might not be fully aware of. Again, there are a lot of people who are, you know, ascribed to the ideology that don't engage in violence at all, but they don't believe in the authority of the local government. They are very anti-tax. They don't believe groups have the right to tax them. They file liens against public officials and police officers. So I think police officers really feel the brunt of this sovereign citizen movement, and they know that it has led to violence against police officers. So they see that. And, you know, even though the Al-Qaeda and the ISIS stuff is national news, it's still very rare in almost every city in America, other than some of the biggest ones, like, you know, New York. Mm-hmm. So I think that's what they told us.
And Professor Kurzman, have those kinds of groups been around? Are there waves and something politically motivates an increase in numbers of those sovereign citizen movements?
I don't have data that would track that, and it's very difficult to collect data in order to assess these kinds of threats and trends. But there's certainly a long history to this kind of violence, and there are historically have been waves of violence that we saw in the 19th century, in the early 20th century, in response to the civil rights movement in the middle of the 20th century. We saw it in the 1990s, the bombing in Oklahoma City grew out of a fringe movement of anti-government extremists. And perhaps we're seeing a new resurgence of those kinds of movements. But I don't have data that would nail that down specifically.
Mm-hmm. But when you think about why we might be experiencing a resurgence, why?
Well, we see certain types of grievances come up over and over with some of these groups. So the election of an African American president it comes up repeatedly. There's fears of the United Nations as though it were about to somehow take control of the United States. Interestingly, Muslim extremism plays into some of the discourses of right-wing extremism, the feeling that Muslims are taking over America, taking over Western Europe. These sort of paranoid ideas that this tiny minority is plotting to subjugate the non-Muslim majority. These are themes that come up, and they may be grievances that have grown in recent years.
Another possible cause is, you know, the demography of this nation is changing, mm-hmm. and a lot of people feel very threatened by that. It's happening nationally. It's not just in our big cities. So soon we will become a majority-minority country. And there are small pockets that just don't accept that destiny. And demography is destiny in many ways.
Let's go to Ryan in Rhinelander. Hi, Ryan.
Hi, how are you today?
Okay, how are you?
Doing well. The reason I'm calling, I'm concerned about groups such as the Oath Keepers, former members of the military, former law enforcement, that call upon members of the military and law enforcement to disobey what they believe to be unconstitutional orders, and groups such as the Constitutional Sheriffs Movement, which are trying to elect as sheriffs people that are associated with, like, the Sovereign Citizens Movement, Posse Comitatus. And I just wonder if your guests might have any comments on that. I'll take my response off the phone.
Thanks, Ryan. Thank you.
Let's distinguish again between electoral political movements that some of us may disagree with, but that are not violent, they're not breaking the law, and movements that whose fringes may end up being violent. That the latter is what we're focusing on with this research. And the question of whether these law-abiding groups may be spawning violent offshoots, I think is a serious question. But let's not go overboard and tar everybody with the same brush.
But if there may be a connection, is it not important for us to explore that further?
Well, isn't that the very issue that we've been dealing with Muslim Americans for the past dozen years? Is how do you investigate and prevent and prosecute instances of violence that are quite rare without violating the rights of the larger community from which they draw? And I think that's a tricky question, but I wonder whether we ought to be rebalancing our calculations on this, given that these violent extremists have proven to be so much rarer than we expected in the months after 9/11, and are still rare on the anti-government extremist side as well. Let's keep in mind that political violence and this extremism of all sorts accounts for a tiny proportion of the violence in the United States that we experience every year. We have over 14,000 murders every year in the United States, according to FBI statistics. Less than 1% in recent years have been due to political violence. So when we calculate this trade-off between security and civil liberties, let's keep in mind that even if we did away with all political violence, which, you know, in a real world we'll never do, we're only accounting for a tiny proportion of the overall level of violence in the country.
Mm-hmm. But at a time, particularly now when we've experienced the horrors in Charleston, there are movements, there are people who are saying that we're reminded of horrible racial discrimination and violence against African Americans when we see Confederate flags. We're reminded of the horrors of the Nazi when we see a Nazi flag. That as a society looking to do something to quell this kind of terror, some of those groups that you have made reference to may fly the Confederate flag, you know, and be proud of it and put on their license plate, or may have swastikas, you know, on their flags or on their cars, et cetera. Does it behoove us to get rid of symbols in this country that are associated with hate?
Well, I certainly think that's a healthy thing, and that we have a democratic process through which all of these issues are mediated, whether it's about anything from health care to race relations. And we're constantly mediating those questions through a democratic process. And that's what violent extremism doesn't do and doesn't accept. It doesn't accept the legitimacy of using a peaceful democratic means to try to mediate our very difficult and controversial disputes, but rather truncates the process. It tries to, the people who engage in it, take that power into their own hands and try to use violence to circumvent the political process and chain and get to outcomes that are really usually almost always unachievable, but they believe or they think that violence is justified to do that.
Professor Kurzman, what do you think?
Yeah, I agree. Let's make a distinction between things that are offensive and things that are physical violence. we can have a debate about whether to get rid of flags or symbols, but violence short-circuits that and removes the democratic political process that we rely on.
Let's go to Little Eagle in Fond du Lac. Hi.
Hi, good morning. Well, you know, I've got 2 points, and the first leads to the second. You know, I think that the radicalization started with the Bush years. They bred fear. It started, you know, ignorance breeds fear. Fear breeds hate. Hate breeds violence. And, you know, it started with that period where everything was, you know, something to be afraid of. And so anyway, then came Obama, and I think Obama had a really calming effect on the population. He sort of calmed their fear, you know, he didn't want the war, and that sort of calmed their fears a little bit. But then they realized that there was a whole new bunch of fears. So we had a white presidency all the way to Obama, and now we've got Obama. And, well, I'm going to tell you, I'm a truck driver, and I go across the United States, and there are radio stations across the nation that spread this sort of thing, this right-wing, you know, radical ideology that is completely void of any semblance for unity or anything like that. And it's all politically motivated. The big corporations are behind all this. But let me tell you, I think that union guy who called in had everything to do with what's going on. I mean, I go across this country. Most of our industry is now sitting overseas. That's also scaring people.
Professor Schanzer, you want to respond first?
Well, I mean, the point I think that bears the most emphasis here is, you know, there is a lot of hate out there. There's a lot of hate spewed on the internet. There's either overt or veiled racism. You hear it in, you know, rhetoric and ideology and things both on the radio, but, you know, and Professor Kurzman and I have both been, you know, targets of this on places like Twitter and so on. And so there is a lot of hate, and it's spewed in many forms. And an impressionable youth who, for some reason or other, has not formed a strong identity and doesn't know where he is and, you know, doesn't have a vision for himself, is lost in many ways. They can latch on to that kind of rhetoric. So while the people are spewing it have every right to do so, there's no doubt that it enters the dialogue, and it can be influential on an individual who eventually could go on and commit violence. There is a connection.
Let's go to John in Appleton next. Hi, John.
Hey, Kathleen, thank you for all you do, the show, the guests, and everyone. Given the fact that the Klan's been around, you know, probably since 1866, and the Southern Poverty Law Center saw and documented such a growth in hate groups after Barack was elected, is it likely that if the GOP wins the White House that we'll see an opposite reduction or elimination of these hate groups? Or will they just find something else to keep their existence going in perpetuity?
Professor Kurzman, you want to start?
Sure. It's, of course, speculation. But I think politics is a rough business. I mean, democracy is a rough business. We tend to romanticize the civility of the past, but people have been playing dirty politics for ages, and it's not entirely a new phenomenon. So having really highly partisan, nasty sounding radio stations, that goes back to the beginnings of radio, and we've only added to that with new forms of media and technology, representative institutions for all their legitimacy as part of our democracy and our democratic commitments, they also can be pretty nasty business. I suspect that we're going to find partisans continuing to duke it out and using some, unfortunately, pretty nasty means and extreme sort of language that can will continue to generate violence on the fringes.
Tamara on Facebook writes this, Professor Schanzer, take it first. I believe that the extreme rhetoric espoused by many right-wing conservatives for political gain gives license for extremists to act out.
Well, again, I don't want to equate legitimate political speech with violence. The perpetrators of the violence are the ones who are responsible for it. What I was referring to in the prior question was, you know, a lot of racist and, you know, just ugly talk that you do see on the internet and sometimes on the radio, less frequently. That's what I was saying could be latched on to. But, you know, all of us, whether it's commentators, radio talk show hosts and all, you know, we'd like to live in a society that is gets along a little bit better and people who participate on social media. So it's really up to all of us to try to, you know, create a little bit more harmonious society and a better one. And hopefully that can bring a reduction to these types of horrible incidents like we saw last week.
Well, what about, let's go back a ways. Let's go back to people like Strom Thurmond or George Wallace. We've been seeing some of their comments back from the 1960s when the Civil Rights Act was under discussion. We hear their comments now and say, oh my gosh, what racist comments these are. Does that not give license for some extremists to act out? Did it not do then that politicians like Wallace gave that point of view a kind of legitimacy?
Well, it certainly did. And what, you know, the problem with, you know, what happened in the 60s was that the state, it was the function of the state, went on and allowed racial violence and to go, you know, unchecked. And indeed, it was elements of the state that were perpetrating it against African-Americans, as well, of course, as private citizens. And I think that's a far, far cry from what we're seeing today. And that's why I disagreed so strongly with, I think it was the first questioner, because the law enforcement agencies are, you know, in Charleston, wherever, are four square against any of this type of violence and are going to do whatever is in their power to prevent it from occurring in the first place. And if it does occur, of course, you know, use the full force of the law, which is being done against the perpetrator of the shootings.
Mm-hmm. Professor Kurzman.
If I could add, we've seen high-profile instances of police violence against African Americans over the past year, I deplore that violence, along with all other forms of violence. But what I'd like to do is if you compare that with the level of violence against African Americans that we saw in this country 50 years ago, I think there was quite a bit more during the Civil Rights Movement than there is today. And that we see many of the politicians who a generation ago might have sided or been not so quick to denounce white violence then. Today, and over the past week, we've seen politicians rushing to denounce the shootings in Charleston. I think that's a sign of improvement. I think it's a sign that we've come some distance over that time. But it doesn't mean we've done away with violent extremism of all forms. And I think that's something that we need to address continually.
You know, Kathleen, if I could add,
yes, go ahead.
A lot of our interviews with the police agencies actually were taking place after or close to the time that the Ferguson incident and then some of the other ones occurred. And, you know, I'd just like to say, of course, we were only talking to a small sample of the police departments in cities around the country, but many of them, you know, looked at what was happening, shook their heads, and kind of said, oh my God, how could these police departments not have gotten the memo that you have to work with your community? If you want to have a safe, harmonious community, you have to work with them, not against them. So a lot of police departments very much understand that and are leaning forward to work together with their communities and find some of the things that have happened over the past year, I think, more abhorrent than even some citizens do.
More phone calls in a moment, 800-486-8655. Our guest wrote a piece in the New York Times that appeared last week, the day before the shootings in Charleston, the killings in Charleston, and they looked at terrorist threats in the United States, that we have a tendency, partially because of the way the press plays this, that the threat to the United States is from violent Muslim extremists or young people who are getting radicalized by going to ISIS on the web and becoming people who will potentially hurt us. But the real extremist threat now is from right-wing extremists. They conducted a survey last year of 382 law enforcement agencies, and a very large number reported anti-government extremism as one of the top three terrorist threats in their jurisdictions. 39% listed extremism connected with Al-Qaeda or organizations like ISIS. Here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655. A couple lines are open for you right now in the last minutes of the show, 800-486-8655. Leave comments on Facebook, the Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is at K Dunn Show. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jeff is our next caller from Eagle River. Hi, Jeff.
Yeah, I'd like to ask the authors if they think there's any relationship between the stagnation of wages in the lower and middle income groups and the rise of these virulent groups.
Yes, that's a possibility that as we see economic difficulties mount for a traditional, especially white working class, that perhaps they would be more susceptible to extremist ideologies. Again, let's keep in mind, though, just because somebody has had downward mobility, let's not consider them as a potential terrorist. We don't want to go too far. But we do see with some of these folks that they do have that kind of a trajectory in their past.
Steve is next in West Bend. Hi, Steve.
Hi. 32 years in the business, retired. Two groups that I worked with or against or trying to stop, I guess. The Ark, the Covenant, and the Sword. It's a group out of Arkansas, and most of these places, groups change their names in several months, and they fund themselves by bank robberies. And when you deal with white males that are going to rob banks, you're dealing with somebody that's ready to go at any minute. And then you have the other regime, you have Earth First, on the left side, who, although hasn't killed a lot of people, has burned a lot of buildings down, and they're lucky they hadn't taken more than they have. They're kind of underground right now, too. So both these extreme groups are there, I can assure you, that they're well monitored by state agents and the FBI and various groups, but there's a lot of hate out there on both sides, and people would be surprised where these people live. There's quite a lot of activity in Wisconsin, but I just agree with both of these gentlemen. I didn't agree with the union guy. That was kind of a fun thing because I think that was off the base. But yeah, they do exist and they are here.
And what kind of
been working?
How did you track them, Steve? Were you a police officer or?
Yeah, basically what happened was is that I was an officer, and I was assigned to a force. And the first one was by accident.
Huh.
Madison called on a gun with a woman. We got the guy. When I opened up his car, there's 40,000 rounds of ammo in there. And when I had to do the inventory search, I said, well, you guys, you better call the FBI because there's 11 pipe bombs in this car. And they were muling from bringing ammo down from the Dakotas, coming and picking it up in Wisconsin and bringing it down to Arkansas.
Huh.
And this stuff goes on. And And
this stuff goes on. It shouldn't go on. Thank you, gentlemen. We're plumb out of time. Thank you very much for being with us this hour.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Thanks for having us.
Our guest, Professor Charles Kurzman, Professor of Sociology at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and Professor David Schanzer, Professor of Public Policy at Duke University. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour and to KP as well for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. We have news coming up from National Public Radio. Get your dancing shoes on. We're going to have some Motown right after the news.